Thank you for attending 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium Session 176, titled Reframing the Grief in a Mixed Faith Marriage. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months, beginning at the end of August 2020. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, as more Mormons experience faith transitions and faith awakenings, many couples find themselves grieved in their mixed faith marriages. In this session, we will explore both personal and professional insights into honoring both the challenging and beautiful aspects of differing beliefs in a marriage. We will highlight the gifts associated with individualization and fostering mutual respect for each other's spiritual journey. We will offer suggestions on reducing conflict, improving communication, and strengthening a couple's emotional connection and intimacy. I'll take a second to introduce you to our speakers before we begin. Natasha Helfer Parker is owner of Symmetry Solutions, a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist, and a certified sex therapist. She's been in practice for over 20 years and specializes in mental health therapy, sex therapy, and sexuality concerns, family couples, services, and faith transitions within spiritual journeys. Sarah Hughes Zabawa is a licensed clinical social worker, certified Daring Way facilitator, and wellness coach working with Symmetry Solutions to offer in-person and online therapy and wellness coaching. Sarah often works with individuals, couples, and families who are impacted by a shift in their spiritual beliefs and who are seeking support in entering this new awakening with better balance, healthier boundaries, and improved trust in themselves moving forward in meaningful ways. Janice Spangler is a graduate of the University of Utah, Integral Coaching Canada, and the Living School. She works as an integral professional life coach with Symmetry Solutions, specializing in coaching individuals, couples, and families affected by the difficulties of shifting faith. She is a frequent guest on other Mormon-themed podcasts, a speaker at conferences, workshops, firesides, retreats, and a guest lecturer at BYU on issues of faith and development. Lisa Butterworth has a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. She founded the Feminist Mormon Housewives website and works for Symmetry Solutions. Lisa offers services to individuals, couples, and families, and specializes in women's issues, faith transitions, sexual concerns, LGBT plus journeys, trauma, anxiety disorders, body image concerns, and depression. Jeff Lundgren has a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling and works as a therapist in the Salt Lake City area at Wasatch Family Therapy and Symmetry Solutions. Jeff serves a variety of individuals with a focus on faith, relationships, marriage, anxiety, depression, trauma, and men's issues. Jennifer White is a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in helping people with depression, anxiety, sexuality concerns, trauma, and faith transitions and journeys. Jennifer works for Symmetry Solutions and has taught sexual education courses at Utah Valley University. Katie Mount is the founder and co-host of Marriage on a Tightrope podcast, where she enjoys connecting with and offering support to others in mixed faith marriages. She offers coaching services to mixed faith couples through Symmetry Solutions. Jenny Elledge is a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in couples counseling, faith transitions, mixed faith relationships, life transitions, and parenting issues. She offers both therapy and coaching services in office and online for couples, adults, older children, and teenagers at Symmetry Solutions. I'll now give the floor to our presenters. Just give me a moment to click the buttons. Okay, the time is yours.
much. All right. Thank you so much. Now that I unmuted myself, I am Natasha Helfer. And let me see, I'm going to try to share our screen and we'll get off and running here, hopefully. All right. Yes. So welcome to Reframing the Grief in a Faith Marriage. Thank you for sitting through all those introductions. There's quite a few of us presenting today. We're really excited to be with you. We are a lot of the members of the Symmetry Solutions team, and we specialize, one of our specialties is working with mixed faith relationships and faith transitions. So we're really excited to share some of our ideas and hopefully best practice type of thoughts for you to find valuable in your own situations. And we hope to leave some time for Q&A, so we're not going to hopefully spend too much time talking at you, but some of it will be that. And it's weird not to be able to see you, so even though I'm super glad that we're doing this, I do miss being able to look at the faces in the conference room, so, you know, but we're all doing our best, so that's good. We want to start out by just validating that, you know, the struggle is real. It's been really interesting as I've worked with other therapists, not necessarily of our faith, and also presenting at different types of national conferences, that sometimes people, you know, don't really see religious differences as a big deal. Like, so what if you think differently, you know? So what if you just have some different ideas and what's the big deal? And at the same time, for many people, and of course, depending on which religious traditions you come from, having people either join or leave your religion can be either a very celebratory process or a very, you know, tragic process for many. And we are not unique to that in Mormonism by any means, but it does cause significant distress for valid reasons. So I just want to put it out there that this is not, you know, a quote unquote silly problem. In fact, it's so valid that the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic Statistic Manual, which is kind of the, you know, Bible of mental health, does have a consideration for religion and spiritual issues, kind of in the back with other, it's not a diagnosis, but it's listed in the back as significant stressors that people might be going through that can impact diagnoses such as clinical depression, anxiety disorders, etc. So it's significant enough that the mental health community does recognize it. And I don't know that I need to tell anybody probably who's listening to us that faith transitions invite/force, whichever way you feel about it, kind of an entire identity makeover. So, you know, the ways that we think about ourselves are highly impacted by the religious cultures that we come from. It has a lot to do about how we see our identity personally, also familially. It has to do a lot with how we see our role in the world, meaning of life, how we think about, you know, the afterlife and existential type of issues. And so, you know, it kind of impacts every aspect of your entity, which doesn't just include you. None of us are islands, right? So if you're the one going through the faith transition, that in of itself can be very difficult. I've had many faith transitioners tell me, you know, that it feels a bit out of control. It's not something that they chose. It's something, you know, that is kind of happening organically within their systems. And so that's difficult in of itself. For the believing family members, especially a spouse, it can feel even more out of control, right? So I kind of usually use the metaphor of a runaway train. The transitioner oftentimes feels like they're the driver of a runaway train. They don't totally have the controls. They don't know exactly what's going on. They don't know exactly what's ahead. And it's scary. Well, a believing spouse can oftentimes feel like they're in the caboose of that runaway train, right? So they're on a ride that they didn't even want to be on. And so that can be extremely challenging for its own reasons too. A little bit about our approach and our agenda as we present some of the concepts that we want to share with you today. I'm a big believer in negotiating and contracting and kind of knowing what you're getting into from the get-go. So I just want to share some of our thoughts and our ideas that will kind of serve as a foundation for all the rest of the information. We take the approach at Symmetry that we are all in mixed faith marriages to some extent. None of us, you know, approach our spirituality in exactly the same way. None of us approach our religious beliefs in the same way. What's interesting, as I worked also with many believing couples, as they deal with issues, as they bring problems into the therapy room, and I ask about their spiritual approaches, sometimes they're surprised themselves at how different they see their own Mormonism, per se, as they hit certain issues in their lives. Even though, you know, they're both still Mormon, that doesn't mean that we all Mormon in the same ways. So a faith transition for one person in your marriage does definitely shift the amount of difference that the two of you will probably be experiencing. But I just want to kind of hopefully normalize a little bit that we are all having our own spiritual journeys anyway. We want to honor both of your journeys. We believe that you have a right to experience this transition in the ways that show up for you. And we're not here to pick sides. We do see spiritual journeys as a very personal thing. And that, of course, lies a conundrum right off the bat, because if you're married, you're having a relational relationship. You're having a relational energy. And so you immediately hit into some of the kind of classic me versus we tensions that any marriage has. You know, any marriage is made up of two individuals that are very different. And yet in this particular issue, it becomes a me versus we tension on steroids. So that's a conundrum that we're here to hopefully help you with. We do not see any type of transition or conversion process as an intentional choice. We believe that people come to their religious beliefs, either whether they're converting towards a religion or leaving a religion, from very organic, genuine spaces. You know, if you open the door to missionaries and what they say seems to make sense, and, you know, your mind is open to some of their ideas and you lean towards those ideas being relevant in your life. We don't see that as you woke up in the morning, you know, wondering, can I join a religion today? You know, that's just kind of a natural thing that happens with however you're showing up with your experiences and your emotions and your personality and how that information impacts you. And we see that very much the same as when people run into experiences or information that lead them to have doubts or transition away from a religion too. We see those processes as actually very similar. We have zero agenda. This is really important. We have zero agenda in regards to your church or testimony status. We hope that for those who lean towards religion, that that's a space of health and well-being and spirituality and, you know, benefit for them, as we also hope that those who find homes in different types of religious or spiritual homes or non-religious homes in of themselves also have well-being and benefit in that journey. So we are not here to influence anybody to stay in the church or to leave the church. And it's actually very important as you work with mental health professionals, which many of you may work with marriage counselors, individual therapists, coaches, et cetera, that you understand that that's actually a very ethical, that's part of the code of ethics of most mental health professions. A mental health professional should not be imposing their own religious or spiritual bias or their non-religious bias onto a couple or an individual themselves. So that is not our role. That is not the hat that we should be wearing, right? If you want those kinds of roles in your life, that would be more like a clergy or ecclesiastical leader, not somebody who's in the mental health community. We also come at faith transitions feeling pretty strongly that we would never want to see a faith transition be the primary reason a marriage or family would dissolve. We understand that couples come at faith transitions with lots of different issues. Usually it's not the only problem that you're facing, but if you have a primarily fairly good marriage, have gotten along fairly well, are doing pretty well in your relationship, and you know, you hit a faith transition, we would probably be biased towards the idea that we would want to help you make your mixed faith marriage work. Now, if a faith transition is maybe the last straw that's breaking the camel's back, there's, you know, been a lot of toxicity in the marriage or chronic concerns, we can understand why that might be an issue that wouldn't feel as approachable to continue the marriage as sustainable. But even then, we lean heavily towards family systems. So just because people divorce or separate, we still think that there's very wise approaches in co-parenting, amicable separation and or divorce. And we encourage people to stay family-centric even when marriages dissolve. So we that is kind of our bias, is we don't see a faith transition as a reason, primary reason to justify leaving a marriage. We do try to be as research and evidence-based as possible in our approaches. We borrow from many other theorists and clinicians that have done great work in the areas of family therapy and systemic approaches to doing mental health work. And we approach all that, we borrow from it and then adopt it to the faith transition issues that we've seen along the years. And I've been working in this kind of expertise area for over 15 years, and many of my providers at Symmetry have been working on these issues for years as well. We will use the terms transitioner and believer as the main ways to refer to kind of the population. We understand that all labels are limited, that labels can be in some ways useful and in some ways minimizing or simplifying in ways that you may not identify with. So if you don't necessarily identify with those terms, we totally get it. And if we were having a one-on-one conversation with you, we would ask what your preferred terms or labels would be. But since we're speaking to a general audience, those are just kind of the terms that made most sense for us to use. All right. Given that, I will turn it over to the next speaker, which is going to be Sarah.
Thanks, Natasha. I think it's really important to frame why are we grieving? There's so much importance in normalizing why grief can occur in our mixed faith marriages. First and foremost, grief is a reaction to loss. We often, as a community and a culture, understand grief in relationship to a death. But the emerging and consistent grief research is the reason we're grieving is there is a shift, a threat, or a loss of attachment. So where there is a fear, risk, or a change in attachment, that is where grief comes forward. We want to also normalize that not every mixed faith couple goes through grief. And yet what we're seeing specifically within our mixed faith Mormon and more fundamental religious congregation and communities is because there hasn't been a model for understanding faith development and differentiation, grief occurs because there is a shift, threat, or loss of attachment. Let's look specifically at what changes could happen regarding our attachment within our mixed faith marriages. There could be loss in a once shared belief or the assumption of belief, like Natasha mentioned. We're all in mixed faith marriages, but typically within Mormonism, we enter our marriage with the assumption that we're on the same page, that our practices, our beliefs, our behaviors will follow a rhythm that was established in its origination. There can be a lost and shared behaviors, right? So someone is sitting at a pew by themselves, potentially. Temple attendance, where that used to be a couple's behavior and ritual, no longer is safe for one person or no longer an option that wants to be explored. So we're literally not even just experiencing an internal threat of loss, we're experiencing a loss of attachment that had significance that we created. In addition, there can be a loss of spiritual language. Mormonism has this really beautiful, interesting lexicon of Heavenly Mother, Heavenly Father, God, the Holy Ghost. We have language that's really unique to us. Like we belong to a stake or a ward and everyone's like, what do you mean a stake, right? We have spiritual language surrounding what we believe, what we love, what we hold dear. And at times for someone who's transitioning, that spiritual language no longer resonates or shifts or is hurtful. So once again, the reason there is grief is the attachment is changing. There's also a loss of certainty in stepping into ambiguity. And as a Mormon culture, we do certainty really well. We're a little younger in our in ambiguity, in the complexity of our spiritual lives and experience. I'm loving the grief research that's coming forward to help us better understand our experience in mixed faith marriages. One is ambiguous grief. This is grieving a person who's actually physically present but psychologically absent. While the research has typically looked at it in the context of mental illness, chronic illness, traumatic brain injuries, and dementia, I just want you to take a moment. Think if you've cared for a loved one who is losing their sense of self with dementia. There is loss there, and yet they're right there. We can touch them, we can feel them, but something has shifted. Attachment has changed. This is very similar to someone who is transitioning, who's having a dark night of the soul. I remember in the midst of my dark night of the soul, I was there, I was physically present, and yet my heart, mind, spirit was very different. I was in a different space. And so sometimes, once again, there's attachment. Where are you? And they're grieving. They're experiencing loss. Also with ambiguous loss, we're grieving a person who's physically present but hasn't had an identity change, and then here's the rub, but is expected to be who they always were. Right? So there's an internal huge shift in attachment internally, my attachment to God, my attention, potentially my attachment to an institution. And yet there's this wrestle within the relationship of, I want you to show up the same, right? And not that that's what everyone decides or expects, but these are the specific languages regarding grief about why they're showing up for us. The second is non-finite grief. And I had the opportunity of just presenting on that if you're needing additional information. But non-finite losses that are consistent on development, the passage of time, and a lack of synchrony with hopes, wishes, ideals, and expectations. Within Mormonism, we have daily and weekly and yearly rites of passage that we experience as a couple. If that's morning prayer, evening prayer, if that is our Sunday attendance, if that is our monthly temple attendance, we have parts of our lived couple experience that starts to shift in a transition. And because of that, non-finite grief comes forward because there's this continual daily, weekly reminder of difference. So that is where grief shows up, because grief is related to attachment, not just to death. It also ushers forward an identity crisis for the transitioner, an identity crisis for the believer. And it makes sense because there's a beginning question of, who are we now? What does this mean for our future? How does this impact our parenting? And one of the reasons the identity crisis comes forward, as well as the grief, is that there is no current doctrinal or cultural permission for differing spiritual development. Now, I want to name that for couples that begin their marriage as mixed faith, there's a little bit more flexibility in our culture, right? There's a little bit more permission. We have a little bit more familiarity of what to do with that. Sometimes there's lacks of boundaries and respect. But for the most part, like, there's at least been a relationship there that was pre-established as different. But when it comes to mixed faith marriages, after the relationship has transitioned, after the relationship has been created, we don't know what to do with that culturally, as a community yet. And this is why we're so dedicated to the work that we're doing, that we can normalize and honor this human experience. The identity crisis moves forward because there's a sense of disconnection from the normal human experience. It is not normal within Mormonism to be married in the temple and then have a transitioner leave. That is not in our lexicon of understanding, which is why in a crisis can come forward. And there's an ongoing sense of powerlessness or helplessness. This wrestle between, I can't not know what I know, and I can't make you know what I want. And there's this internal wrestle and feeling powerless in changing the other person. And also in our ability to move backwards from where we once were. or where we are now. And also in the relationship to non-finite loss, shame, embarrassment, and self-doubt can happen for both partners of the believer and the transitioner. And that needs to be named because it's a parallel process. The context is different, but the process is similar. And once again, we're changing our behavioral norms as a couple. And oftentimes, it's what we've built our relational identity around, hence why we have a crisis.
Next is going to be Jenny Ellich.
Hi. Thank you, Sarah. So as we consider our identities, we want to introduce to you the concept of differentiation. So differentiation was developed by Dr. Bowen a few decades ago, and he has, he proposed a theory in two major parts. So number one, differentiation of self is the ability to separate feeling from our thoughts. So undifferentiated people cannot separate their feelings and their thoughts. So when they are asked to think, they're actually flooded with feelings. They have a hard time accessing the logical parts of their brains and being able to come up with a logical response. Secondly, undifferentiated people have difficulty separating their own feeling from other people's feelings. And so therefore, they start to look to their family or their partners or their spouses to define how they think about issues, how they feel about people, and even how they interpret their own experiences. So in other words, differentiation is the process of freeing yourself from your family processes to define yourself, your own identity. So this means being able to have different opinions and values than your family members or your spouse or your partner, and be able to stay emotionally connected to them. I just want to pause right here and circle back to that very beginning part where it says this means being able to have different opinions and values from your family members. That's actually something that we know to be like individuation. That's like part of personal development, to be able to claim your own identity. Differentiation adds another layer to that. And it says that we also want you to stay emotionally connected to the people that you're in a relationship with. And so it also means to be able to calmly reflect on a conflicted interaction afterward, realize your own role in it, and then choose a different response for the future. So we know that all couples have differentiation challenges, and because we're people. And we know that Mormonism tends to add its own flavor, right? So a lot of Mormonism has they model the doctrine and the culture kind of model sameness. We all kind of believe the same and we all have the same end goal. And along that journey to achieve that end goal, we have these set of behavioral markers to achieve. And so we realize that Mormonism can have its own unique challenge. And yet, when we just sort of look at all couples, you know, across the globe, we can see that all couples and their partners in those couples are very, very different people, sometimes very different. And they can experience those differences without a lot of tension and without a lot of pain. So some examples of that would be like your hobby. Let's say one partner really loves to run marathons and the other partner really loves to do woodworking. You know, they experience those differences without a lot of tension, without a lot of pain. Or they have a different taste in music. One's a little bit of country, the other a little bit of rock and roll. And then I think we're all familiar with the five love languages, maybe. So one person could be the gift giver and the other person could be someone who loves affection. And so you tolerate those differences in your partner because you realize that's just who they are. And you don't ask them to change to accommodate you. Another thing to consider is our individual autonomy versus systemic integrity. And so what we mean by that is that when we choose to be in a relationship with someone, a long committed relationship, we know that we have our own individual needs, our partner has their own individual needs, and we have that relational layer where we also have couple needs, and we also have family needs that looks like, you know, meeting the needs of our in-laws or meeting the needs of children if we have them. And so that requires ongoing communication to figure out how that's going to look and how that's going to show up in your relationship. And part of that ongoing communication, you want to consider in your relationship how much space you have for safety in being vulnerable with your partner. Do you have the space to show up for your partner and to accept them for who they are? Or is it a lot of, I don't know if I can tell all my deepest, darkest secret because I don't know if they're going to like me anymore. So that's something for you to consider as well. We know that research from the Gottman Institute suggests that one of the most important skills we can develop in a relationship is the ability to tolerate the emotional reactions of our partner without taking it personally or needing to feel like we need to change them or fix them. And so we want to offer you three ideas on how you can do that. Number one, try to be patient. I mean, that's kind of a universal goal for everyone in any relationship. We know that we're always going to stumble. Two, be curious. You want to be kind of open with your and curious about your partner. Don't expect them to always be the same, you know, throughout the years. So if you're like freshly into this new navigation of a mixed faith marriage, there might be a lot of curiosity happening, like what is actually happening? What do you actually believe? But even if you're 5 or 10 years into this, you know, that curiosity still needs to be there because people change over time. And then finally, just be willing to tolerate tension. I mean, that's an important life skill personally, to be able to tolerate tension. And in within your own relationship, that will be very helpful too. So now we're going to talk about boundaries.
And that's Lisa Butterworth.
Hi. So, I don't know. My video isn't showing up for me. Is it showing up for other people? I'm still seeing Natasha.
We can see you. Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So what is a boundary? I think the most efficient way of deciding what a boundary is or understanding what a boundary is this idea of this is okay with me and this is not okay with me. And it's a little bit oversimplified and it's easier said than done, right? Like sometimes we think something is okay with us and then later we decide maybe it wasn't. And sometimes it's really complicated because we might really want to do something for our family or for our kids and think that it's okay with us and then only later realize we're feeling resentful or angry about it. And so, you know, it takes practice to figure out what the boundary is, but that's the basic idea of this is okay with me and this is not okay with me. We need boundaries because self-care, we're really into self-care right now. So, you know, everybody knows we need to do it. We need to be able to communicate our needs. And it's important in mixed faith marriages because if we don't communicate our boundaries, we're going to start building up a lot of resentment, and nobody wants to be living in a marriage full of resentment. So, and then setting healthy limits and expectations, and there will be a whole nother section on setting limits and expectations. So some examples of unhealthy boundaries, and I feel like this is something that culturally we see a lot. Right? Because there are some expectations of us culturally that don't necessarily contribute to us having good boundaries. So if you really have trouble saying no to things, even when you really would like to, you're probably showing some unhealthy boundaries. If you feel responsible for other people's feelings, if you find yourself maybe sharing too much too soon or never sharing, right? Depending on the context. Right? Like if you're never sharing in a relationship with your partner, then that's too, you know, like then your boundaries aren't very good because this is your person, right? We need to be sharing. If you're sharing too much with random strangers, then that's not a good boundary either. Not knowing what you want is evidence that you're not sure, that you're not clear on your boundaries. Not knowing who you are, or anytime you feel like you have to do something. If you feel like you have to, you haven't chosen to, and you haven't decided what's okay with you and what's not okay with you, right? Like, you've just accepted somebody else's expectation. So why do we struggle with boundaries? One of the big ones is that we feel like maybe our needs are selfish, or maybe what I want is selfish, or what's okay with me is selfish. That's a big word, right? It's a big word, and it's really rooted in shame. The idea that maybe I don't deserve the things that I need, which I'm not saying like it's super easy, because sometimes our needs and our wants can get all messed up, and sometimes we can be selfish. I've been selfish. But meeting our basic needs are not selfish. And if we have resentment coming up in us, or if that we can feel ourselves doing things constantly that we really don't want to be doing, it's not selfish to set a boundary. And we really have to learn how to do it. Another reason we struggle is Mormon culture just doesn't teach us boundaries very well. I love my Mormon people. I love us so much, but boundaries is not one of the things that we thrive at. Also, we don't have a lot of practice at asking, what do I want? What do I need? Often we distrust that. Often we distrust that if I ask myself, what do I want? What do I need? That we'll constantly want selfish things. And it's not true for the most part. I mean, most of us actually want things that are good for the world and good for us and good for our kids and good for our spouse. So if we ask ourselves, what do I want? And we trust that we'll want good things, then we have the freedom to make those choices. And then fear of rejection, right? There's definitely pretty explicitly an understanding that if we say no, someone might get mad at us. Or even like in the context of church, if I were to say no to a calling, I might, you know, like not be asked to have another calling, or there might be a judgment that there's something wrong with me. I've definitely felt that myself. Or fear of confrontation, right? Like, how many times have we heard that contention is of the devil, right? Fear that if we say something, if we don't go along, that, you know, like we'll be making a fuss. And those, you know, these fears are real, but there are ways to do this that don't necessarily create contention, right? Like, we might need to have some assertiveness, but we don't have to create contention, so to speak. So that's the next slide, which is how to set boundaries. So this isn't probably new to anybody, but I language is really important. So saying I need some time to myself, rather than saying something like, you need to stop bothering me, which I'm totally guilty of saying things like that. Learning to say no, and learning to hear no, right? Because if we want to learn ourselves to be able to say no to something, we have to stop having strings attached to what we want from other people, right? And so learning to hear no is just as important as learning to say no. So being really clear about what you want, being firm, being respectful, and trying not to over-explain. When we're first setting boundaries, we can like really go into some in-depth explanations about why we deserve to have a boundary. And, you know, like if you're actually talking to your spouse, you might want to go into a little more depth. But if you're setting a boundary with someone outside of your immediate family, just say, that doesn't work for me. And try not to apologize for setting a boundary, because if you apologize, it sort of implies that your needs aren't important or that they don't matter. And that's the thing we're trying to move past. This next one is super hard. We have to kind of detach from the other person's reaction. This is about learning to hear no, or, right? Like, you need to expect that if you've always said yes to somebody, if you've always said yes to your mom, or if you've always said yes to your partner, if you've always said yes to the bishop, and this time you say no, that they may have a poor reaction, that they may feel like you're doing something wrong, that they may accuse you of being selfish. Expect that to happen, but also try and frame it in terms of that is their problem to deal with. Those are their feelings. They need to learn how to hear no too. And then finally, expect that you're going to feel selfish, you're going to feel guilty, and you're going to feel embarrassed, you're going to feel like you're breaking the rules. And I know this is hard, especially for those of us who like keeping the rules, which isn't me, so I don't really struggle with that one too much. I love rules, so. But if you're one of the people who loves following the rules, you kind of have to do it anyway, right? Like, think of it as a new rule. Your new rule is setting good boundaries. So, you know, like, reframe it a little bit so that it still goes along with your values of following the rules, but still, you've got to do it anyway. And it's normal to have these feelings. It's normal because you're breaking a rule that's broken and not serving anybody, but at the same time, it's still scary to break it. And in the end, you'll get better relationships. Maybe not with everybody. Like, some people may not be able to handle your new boundaries, but the people that you are making better relationships with, those relationships will be realer, deeper, truer, because you're not all pretending. You're telling, you're being firm, you're being fair. You're not pretending, you're not doing things you don't want to do. This takes time. It's just going to take some time. And you're going to have to practice it. And you're not going to do it right, which, again, that's going to drive the perfectionists crazy. I know there probably aren't any perfectionists in the room, because this is a Mormon thing. And so none of us are perfectionists, right? You're not going to do it right the first time. You're going to make mistakes. Look at your mistakes, gather data, adjust how you set those boundaries, adjust where your boundaries are, and go on. And then, most importantly, and did Sarah talk about this, or was this in her last session? Anyway, you got to find a friend or two to help you keep these boundaries. Because if you're pushing up against your culture in your family or in other places, you need someone who will back you up. You need to be able to check in with someone who says, no, you're not crazy to say no to taking 500 cupcakes to the soccer championship. You're not crazy. You have a right to say no to that. You can buy them at the store, or you can expect someone to bring half of them. You can set a boundary and you're not crazy. So check in with that person, find that person first, and then check in with them regularly and have them be your backup that this is okay to set boundaries.
Okay, now we have Jennifer White talking about realistic expectations.
Yeah, and I really appreciate everything that everyone said. And a lot of what I'm talking about does include these concepts. I think it's so important for us to have realistic expectations in a relationship, you know, and realize, you know, not selling ourselves short of, you know, things that we can expect. And also not like glorifying, like, this relationship's just going to be perfect and amazing and solve all our problems, you know, so just being realistic. So I'm going to go through some of these things about, like, first, what a relationship cannot be. No one person can be everything you need. If we think historically, we had a whole community to support us, you know, a whole village. And it's, I often see, you know, people kind of relying maybe just on their spouse for a lot of that. And for me, that is really overwhelming, you know, for that to be my job to take care of that. And at the same time, our needs are valid. And real. And so, you know, being creative and including more people in our support system is important. So next one, no one person's job to fix the other person or do the bulk of emotional labor, you know. Sometimes we see this in Mormon culture. We see it and show up in different ways, you know, where maybe it's, I've seen it both ways, but sometimes it's maybe the wife that is given that responsibility to fix everything or to fix their spouse. And when you're trying to fix your spouse, it kind of definitely takes away from maybe your sexual energy, for one thing. We normally don't want our spouse to be our teacher. Let's see. And no one person can be the person that you spend all your time with. Now, I'm going to acknowledge with COVID, this has been kind of hard. It's hard on a lot of relationships. A lot of us, depending on where we are, have had to isolate, and we've kind of seen the effect of that and hopefully learning from that. But I just want to validate that that hasn't been easy. You don't, your spouse being your only friend, again, that can be really overwhelming for a lot of people. And that there is room for us to have other friends other than just our spouse. We all need support, good support systems. I mean, and that's part of like holding a container for the majority of emotions for one person is very overwhelming. And it's nice to have different people in your support system that you go to, maybe with your intellectual things or your emotional things, and just have that good support system. No one person can love absolutely everything about you. I know we kind of get the message in the movies that, that you know, we're going to meet this one person, but it's normal to get annoyed and not always, yeah, love everything. No partner can do things for you that maybe you need to do for yourself. Again, it's not one job to take care of the other person. We're not a parent in this relationship. And sometimes with one person having a big transition, this can happen on both sides, you know, where they want to like fix the other person or save the other person. And this definitely happens on both sides. And a partner cannot be responsible for the needs that have not been communicated. So this goes into like, sometimes we want our spouse to mind read and know. And it doesn't matter how long you've been married, you cannot mind read what your spouse is thinking. And it's important for us to kind of maybe stand up for ourselves and use those I statements and share, you know, these are what my needs are. These are the things that would help you at the same time, not that it's the other person's job to fix all that. So yeah, I definitely find that important. Now, there are a lot of beautiful things that relationships can have. And a lot of these things do take a lot of work, but they are possible. Of course, we deserve to be treated with respect. You know, it's important that we feel overall have a sense of safety in a relationship. I've emotionally in different areas, I have done work with domestic violence where I've seen this, like, where people really didn't feel safe in their relationship, and kind of the consequences of that. And give yourself permission to be flexible and find out what works. You know, we in our relationships, we can have flexibility. It's not going to look like everyone else's relationship, and that's okay. We don't all fit into some box. And it takes a little extra work to maybe figure out what that's going to look like. And this is going to look very different at different times in our lives. For example, like I know when I was going to grad school and doing internships and stuff like that, my husband did the majority of like the housework and the cooking. And then, you know, maybe there's other times where he had more stress and just being able to adjust and be flexible about with those things, I think is important. Room for differences. So this is really important. This has already been really explained very well. This concept of differentiation, that actually having differences can improve the relationship and just make it so beautiful. I know that, like, so even for me, like in my own relationship, my husband and I have different political parties, and it's really brought much more interesting conversation and dialogue. And that can happen the same way with different beliefs and faith. And sometimes that one has been a little bit harder, but we can make room for that. One thing I always like to normalize in our relationships, we're gonna have conflict. And if we're never having conflict, I worry about that. Sometimes that might not be healthy. I don't want to say all the time it's not healthy, but it's normal for conflicts to come up, and how we deal with that is important. It's important to have room to grow and heal yourself in your relationship, so a lot of times therapy can help with that. It's very important, like with this idea of feeling safe, like we want to feel safe to share our experiences with our partner and or share some hard things and not have them freak out too much, because then it doesn't feel safe to share again. And also, I want to give room that we're going to make mistakes and sometimes freak out. And it's very important when those things happen to apologize and to make repair attempts. John Gottman talks a lot about this. He's kind of one of the most respected marriage therapists and just done a lot of research, and that can make a difference. And I want to take a moment just to share kind of a really short story about this one. I got permission to share this, but there's a couple I'm working with, and they had one of those horrible arguments where just everything comes out, and sometimes we're not our best selves when we're really angry. We're not thinking through what we said, and some things were taken the wrong way, and some things were said that weren't really how they felt. And so it was really important for them to have a chance to have a redo of that conversation, to have a sincere apology and owning what they said. And it was a beautiful thing to witness how hard they worked at that. I've called this, that this was the game changer for them, the turning point in their relationship. And they're trying to give more power to that, which isn't always easy, to give more power to that, to the redo and to the apologies and to, when they owned that and when they really felt connected. And I've just been really impressed with them really showing up and doing that work. So, yeah. The next thing is, in relationships, there are two valid realities. There's two different experiences people are having. Often we hear about gaslighting, and this is where there isn't room for maybe one of those experiences. That's one way of seeing that. And so if we can realize, okay, this was their experience, and that's valid, and then, when there's time to share what that experience was for you, because we all kind of experience the world a little bit different. This is hard work, I'm going to acknowledge. This is really not easy to do. So give yourself permission to mess up. I mess up all the time. So the next time, to feel love the majority of the time. It's important to feel loved. 24/7 may not be realistic. We all have our moments of not really maybe showing the love we have. Definitely that we're creating more possibilities than we're taking away in our relationship. We don't want to limit to recontrolling where those dreams of the other aren't possible. There needs to be space and this can be a hard one, but it's a basic need of a space for each of us to be seen, heard, and valued as individuals. Yes, we're a couple, but we're also individuals, and space for that is important. As well, as it's realistic to expect intimacy, and there are lots of different types of intimacy, and don't have time to go through all that, but I will say that I do think that sex is of an important part of relationships. And so that can be part. Sometimes we need help from a certified sex therapist to work on that, but it is important in our with our partners or marriages.
Hey, Jeff Lundgren is going to talk about some of how to approach difficult conversations.
So obviously in any relationship, there's difficult conversations. So a faith transition just compounds that. So if there's existing communication complications in that relationship, this may be more challenging, but I think it's important to recognize that it can be challenging. So one of the strategies that's very helpful is to start with common values. And that's a process of kind of digging down underneath the layers of beliefs to arrive at commonalities and focus on the things that are in common. For example, we both believe in a strong ethic for health, or we both have a strong attitude towards fidelity in our relationship, or those types of things. When you do talk, choose a place that is conducive in terms of time and location to a healthy conversation. There's times that it's probably just not the best time to dive in into difficult conversations. So choose wisely. I think one of the perfect antidotes for challenging conversations is complete vulnerability. So go in, as we've talked about, owning it and saying, this is really uncomfortable for me because I feel this. And that type of disclosure will help your partner have compassion on you, and it doesn't seem so defensive, and it lowers the defense in general. I think it's helpful to identify the fears that you're experiencing. So a faith transition, you know, is just, it's upsetting for a partner, for the believing partner as an example, because they feel that they're having to make all these compromises for the transitioning spouse, and that creates fear. Well, what kinds of fears? And it's good to name it, because if you can name the emotions and identify them, they become the stepping stones to navigate challenging conversations. It's helpful to identify and reflect about the stories that we tell ourselves. What do we derive from the components of the faith transition, whether we're the transitioning or we're the believing spouse? What does that do to us? How does that spawn off stories that we say, oh, well, this must mean such and such a thing? And that's helpful to identify and objectively analyze the thoughts that we're having as a part of the experience. It's helpful to identify the strengths that we have. For example, many relationships, in fact, I would say the vast majority of relationships, even if one partner is experiencing a transition in their faith, there are huge strengths that both partners in the relationship can draw from that would support really healthy conversations or experiences. And lastly, as a part of how you might approach it, is look for the things that the experience is giving to you in the form of a gift. How can you take a positive reframe in something that may appear challenging and find that golden nugget in there that's going to promote a healthy long-term relationship? So there are some common things that I would say are difficult conversations, and I thought this would be helpful just to talk about one of these. For most people, the thing that they talk about the most is, well, we want to talk about truth claims. For example, I read that, you know, Joseph Smith, whatever, or, you know, I found out such and such a thing, and this doesn't, you know, resonate with me anymore. In fact, I think it's false. Your spouse, right, the believing spouse, may not be the best person to hash that out with. These are challenging things, and they may go at the core of fundamentally what defines either partner in the situation. So as it comes to truth claims, as we've talked about before, it's helpful to find a community or a friend that can help you and hold space for those types of conversations. we've talked a little bit about recontracting, but there's a few things that are helpful in the types of difficult conversations that one would want to have. One is around sex and intimacy. Anytime we change gears or complete directions in terms of what we believe theologically or spiritually, it affects so many things, and sex and intimacy is going to be a part of it. As an example, there may have been sexual behaviors or experiences that maybe a believing spouse would have felt were taboo that in a faith transition, they're more open to. It's important to incorporate that in with the spouse in conversation and say, hey, this is something that I think I might be open to where I wasn't before. What do you think about that? Right. And have some malleability to the contract between the partners in that way. Substance use could come up. Maybe one spouse decides, hey, I think I can actually drink coffee now. So what does that mean? Have the conversation. Definitely clothing and attire, not just because maybe one spouse chooses not to wear temple garment anymore. Maybe this also means that they may dress in a different way that the temple garment probably would have made a certain attire difficult to wear. And so it comes with all kinds of things. Morality may be an extension of that. Sabbath day observance. Well, what do we do on Sunday now? Or what am I going to choose to do on Sunday now? And how does that impact our family? Tithing can be a big and challenging conversation, because where one's charity may have gone to the church previously, a transitioning spouse may feel uncomfortable in that. Not that they don't believe in charity, but they may want to do it in a different way. So it's things to recontract. Fidelity can be a scary thing. One thing that I've heard clients say is, well, now that my spouse no longer believes, are they going to cheat on me? Are they going to, you know, be promiscuous? No, not at all. But it's something that comes up. So it's an important conversation to have. And it's a difficult conversation for some couples. Politics can be affected because sometimes our religious attitudes will include certain prescriptive political ideals that when that changes, that our politics change. So it's important to sit down and say, well, yeah, I don't believe this politically anymore. That doesn't mean that it undermines the relationship, but it may be a helpful thing to have in some situations with a spouse. Now, how do we parent kids, right? What are the values that we teach kids? How do we talk about boundaries and what is or is not appropriate behavior for children at certain developmental ages, of course? But this comes up as well as an example of a difficult conversation. And I would say the biggest conversation of all of this is, well, what about us? Because we got together because of the church in many cases, or we got to be together because of the commonalities we had spiritually. Well, now that may be different. So are we still a thing? And it's really important to have that conversation, say, no, we're still a thing. Like, this may be different in this way, and they always will, and help to provide some reassurance back to the believing partner. And of course, that could go both ways.
Okay, turning it over to Katie Mount.
Okay, did you switch the slide already?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just don't see it. That's fine. Okay, so I'm going to talk about self-care. And this is a really important one. I think it's one that we neglect. I think a lot of times we neglect ourselves because we are trying to figure out what's going on in our relationship. We're worried about our kids. We're worried about what other people are going to think. And sometimes we get in a place where we can be really unhealthy and not take care of ourselves. So some of the things that we can do here that I wanted to talk about is things like, you know, having support, and specifically having support from someone who's earned the right to hear your story. We all have very good friends and family members that are well-meaning, but that give some very bad advice, right? All of us have been there. So you can either find someone that is a professional to give you good advice, maybe someone who's a therapist or a life coach that can give you an outside view, or just maybe a different perspective, help you work through some of the hardships you're facing in your marriage and that you need and want to talk about. You know, my spouse gave me permission to talk to anyone that I wanted to. And so I found someone that was a cheerleader for me, who would love me and respect me as well as my husband, no matter what was going on. And I think that support of some kind, either in a community or in a Facebook group, whatever that might be, is very healing for yourself as you can talk through a lot of the things that you're dealing with. It's important to go through the grief cycle. You know, I think that when you allow to feel those feelings that come on of shock and anger and then just disbelief, and then you're coming around to accepting where you're at, it's important to feel every single one of those emotions. And really, you know, feeling those emotions doesn't mean that you won't experience them down the road, right? I call it waves of grief. There are things that I grieved over and over and over again, and they may be for different reasons, but you allow those emotions to come and you recognize them and then you move on. And as time passes, I felt like it has gotten a lot better. Meditation, I have found a lot of healing in meditation. There are numerous amounts of apps out there or groups that you can join to do meditation, yoga, anything that would bring you to that place of mindfulness where you can recognize how you're feeling. You can see that you're upset about something, or you can see that you're overcoming or healing from something else. It's really helpful to reflect on what you are thinking and feeling and also what you value. And that was something that you could do that has been helpful, is writing down exactly what I value and then moving forward with those values. Another helpful thing was routine. So I wrote down a list of things that really helped me in my day to feel good. And things like this can help you just move forward, right? Not feeling like you're stuck, like you have something to count on. So that could be physical activity. We love upbeat music in our house, so that could be your favorite album. I know that sometimes you can connect to music, especially through emotions. And so feel all those feelings and listen to the music and let it uplift you. Or if you want to grieve, let it take you down to that place. Having a morning routine, having a nighttime routine, and getting enough sleep is so important. Those types of things will keep you physically going when sometimes you're just so emotionally exhausted because you're talking about these things constantly, right? Another thing is you need to model how you want to be treated. So immediately right up front, my husband and I provided a united front to our friends and family about where we were. We were open and honest with them. We acknowledged that it would be hard, but we were committed to each other. So think about the ways that you want to model how you want to be treated, and then model those to your friends and family. And then strengthen your inner authority. And like Lisa said, a lot of these things have already been talked about, but boundaries are important. And you can create boundaries for your friends and your family and even your spouse in your marriage. If you want to talk, like Jeff talked about, if you want to talk, find an ideal place to sit down and have those conversations. Maybe even give yourself a time frame. But what's important here is that you are following your inner voice. Someone is not telling you how you should feel. You are recognizing and thinking about how you feel. And in turn, you model that to other people and you show them how you're using your own authority to teach others how they should treat you. And, you know, I'll just say this. I had a very well... meaning family member that wanted to tell me about a dream they had about me and my spouse. And I had to stop them right there. And I said, you know, if this is not helpful to my marriage, I do not want to hear it. And that was it. And I obviously was not a happy dream because they never told me what that dream was. And, you know, that was one way that I could show that I had authority over myself to hear the things I wanted to hear. And then the last thing is to allow joy and humor to accompany your difficult times. Alan and I laugh a lot. And, you know, this can look different in so many ways for so many people. But I think it is so important that sometimes we just have to laugh instead of cry or get upset. You know, you can do this by finding your favorite show, you know, The Office, Parks and Rec, whatever it is. Go to a comedy show. Take a break. Go for a walk. My favorite story is, you know, we had been in this a couple years and we were at church. It was Easter Sunday. We're sitting in the pew and we're singing about Christ. And then all of a sudden I realized, I turned to Alan and I said, wait, do you believe that Christ was divine? And it was like, we both just started laughing because I thought, wow, I had never even thought that maybe you would think differently about this. So allow the joy, allow the humor, and inject it into those really hard, difficult times, because it will be a breath of fresh air. And that's all my tips on how you can practice self-care.
Can I just find the humor that the person speaking about self-care has a black eye?
It was a baseball to the face. I'm sure the audience will forgive me.
Yeah. You look beautiful. All right, to Jana okay. Spangler.
All right, we're just going to talk a little bit about spiritual reconnection. I'm going to try to keep this really brief because I would love to get to all of your questions. So one of the things that I find in the mixed faith couples that come to see me is a deep mourning, typically on the part of the believer, but sometimes on both, that we can't talk about spiritual things anymore. I feel like every time I try to share something that's near and dear to me, it causes pain and stress to my spouse. And so it can really feel like a deep place of disconnection. Not all of us do this, but I find it to be very common in our society. This is not just an LDS thing, that we often conflate religion and spirituality. We think that when we are acting out our religion, that that is spirituality. And sometimes it is, sometimes it's the access way to spirituality, but they really are two different things. And I find with mixed faith couples, it can be really, really helpful to start piecing those two things apart and concentrating on what spirituality really is, because there is a way to still connect spiritually, even if our religious expression starts to change. So just quickly, religion, basically, when I'm using that word, I'm referring to the specific beliefs and practices and organizations that help connect us. Spirituality, what I'm talking about, that it's dealing with the internal individual process of forming your own identity, your meaning making, your connectedness to the world, to God, to whatever. If you look at that definition, I hope you can start to see how spirituality continues to thrive if you're human. All of us have a spiritual connection, even if the transitioner is going through a time of identifying as agnostic or atheist. Often even the idea of spirituality starts to feel a little threatening. But really, if you're human, you are going to be dealing with ideas of identity, meaning making, and connection to whatever it is you imagine is out there. Even if it's just your shared humanity, shared connection to creation, shared experience with your family and friends and people that you know and your spouse. So using that can open up some new possibilities for how we can actually connect. The King Solomon analogy goes like this. I'm sure we're all familiar with the Bible story of King Solomon, when the women came to him fighting over this baby, both saying that this baby belonged to them. And King Solomon says to them, well, what we'll do is we'll just cut the baby in half and we'll give a half to each of you. And of course the true mother spoke up and said, no, please give the baby to her. I don't want the baby harmed. And you know, this is just a beautiful story of what we can connect to, this aspect of real love that cares more for the well-being of someone else, even if they are going to be taken from us or go in another way. Now, hopefully in your mixed faith marriage, as Natasha said at the beginning, we hope that you can work through that if that is the main thing challenging your marriage, and you won't have to actually physically have that person taken from you. But in their religious expression, are we willing to make that sacrifice to allow them to find the ways, the traditions, the practices, the things that allow them to thrive and maintain that growth in their spiritual connection, even if it is not with our faith. And for the transitioner, can you allow the believer to continue to thrive in their chosen expression of connection with the church? And can you help them to be able to express that authentically for themselves? I just want to mention that spirituality isn't just about feeling good. In fact, spirituality, really deep spiritual work, can often be extremely uncomfortable. And that's because it often is leading us to growth, which, unfortunately, I'm really sorry to say that growth requires pain. And through our being present to our discomfort, just as an individual and as a couple, it is where our biggest growth can occur. So when things get really uncomfortable in your spiritual lives together, I would encourage you to lean into that, to pay attention to it, and not to run from it or feel, you know, you will feel threatened by it. You will feel those things. Be kind to yourself, but lean in and see what you can do to care for yourself and for your spouse as you both deal with that discomfort. So what I'm saying is discomfort is not necessarily an indication that things are off or that you are doomed. It is often just a sign that there is an opportunity here for you to lean into some deeper growth. And I just will just say for myself, working with mixed faith couples, it's some of the most beautiful growth that I've ever seen when a couple can lean in to one another and allow the wisdom of the other person's experience to permeate them. So I would just encourage people with these last two, find mutual support. So can you do this for your spouse? Can you do this for yourself? Can you define what helps you come alive spiritually? And can you help support each other in what that is? Can you get curious? Can you listen? Employ your empathy and creativity, all the good things that we've already talked about in this presentation to enliven both of you and allow you both to find a new spiritual path. And then can you find ways to do this together? You know, like I said, even the atheist, even them, has a spiritual life, right? So, you know, how can you find activities that inspire both of you, that mean something to both of you? Can you ask each other questions that when we've been married for 20 years, I can tell you, I don't ask these questions very often of my spouse, but we could really have an opportunity to grow together if we would ask each other things like, you know, what helps you feel belonging? What inspires you in life? You know, what do you find right now to be the purpose of your life? What is calling to you? You know, these are kinds of conversations we can start to have where we really continue to grow together. And if your spouse has things in those answers that trigger you as far as, oh, but that's not with the church, or, oh, that's with the church, can you just rest in that discomfort? Notice that that is coming up. Do some self-soothing and stay engaged in the conversation to get curious about why that is and how you can support each other through that growth.
Thank you. So we have a few resources that we want to share with you. I've written a little book called One Family, Two Views, When Mormons Doubt by John Ogden. We love John Gottman's work. He's written both the 7 principles for making marriage work and also 8 dates to help you have some of those spiritual fun experiences that Jana's talking about. Nonviolent Communication is a great resource. Hold Me Tight by Sue Johnson. These are all just really very, you know, renowned people that talk about relationships in general. We do have podcasts. Mormon Mental Health is a podcast that talks about a lot of different topics, but mixed faith and faith transitions comes up often in that. Katie and her husband, Alan, run Marriage on a Tightrope, and they, in partnership with me, have also come up with a workshop, which we're calling it Workshop on a Tightrope. It's a 6-week course for mixed faith couples in particular, and we just started round 2. We're really excited about that.
lots of Facebook groups. Marriage on a Tightrope has a Facebook group. Mormon Mixed Faith Marriages is another one. Mormon Mental Health Association is an association I helped found about 6-7 years ago. We have vetted all of the therapists and educators and coaches on that directory to be, one, culturally competent so that they understand Mormonism. You don't have to spend like 10 sessions explaining Mormonism to a non-LDS therapist, and also to be the types of therapists and coaches that would support both parties and not take sides. We take that very seriously. And of course, we have our group practice, which is Symmetry Solutions. And yeah, so those are some of the resources. And without further ado, I'll try to stop share here so we can maybe have time for a few questions. See if I can figure this out.
Thank you. So if you would like to submit a question, please type it into the Whova app, and then I can read it to the panel. I see that several people have already put in questions. And the one that has the most votes, I don't know if you knew you could vote for a question, but that might have the most interest, asks, how typical is it to be on the other end of a faith crisis, maybe even both spouses, and then grieve that you didn't experience different partners and variety of sex before getting married as a virgin?
So I'm going to pause that question and redirect you to tomorrow's session, where we're going to talk about what ifs and sexuality. It's actually very common, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow. So, ding, next. Okay. Sorry.
That's fine. The next one. My husband is a full-time seminary teacher. My faith has transitioned, and his has some, but not as much. We are okay as a couple, but I feel I can't completely be myself because of his employment. I'm not sure where to go from here.
Sarah.
Can I speak to that? I want to name that's complex, right? And one of the most important parts about moving in what we call non-finite loss and non-finite grief is bringing those fears to the table. Shame lives in secrecy. And so if we can, I'm wondering, because I don't know the dynamics of your relationship, would there be a safe space to have that conversation with your partner? Even saying, this is what's moving in me. These are the desires I'm having. These are the interests I want to explore. Can we talk about how you feel about that while also respecting this is important to me? Understanding the complexity of having a spouse in a church-based, temple-recommend-based position, we need to name that there's limitations there potentially. It might actually be really beautiful for your spouse to also hear you're feeling that tension, because he might as well. So my greatest suggestion would be protect a time that is low stress in a location where there's privacy. In COVID land, grab a picnic blanket, go to the park, and start asking some open-ended questions. Say that this is important to you and that you need him to listen, and also that you'd like to partner with him in creating next steps decisions together.
Thank you.
Really quickly to add to that, I would just say this is also a boundary issue, and this is also a self-care issue, right? So I think you've heard principles around boundaries that Lisa talked about, and you also heard about this idea of who earns your trust. And self-preservation and family preservation is also a concept, and this idea of what we might do individually authentic versus systemically authentic, you know, what's best for our family at this particular time. So if you're dependent on the finances and things of that nature, you may need to make strategic choices that pace your ability to be more open to your community. And that might impose on your individual authenticity for a minute, but if you can tap into your concepts of being systemically authentic, then it doesn't feel like such an affront to your personal self.
Thank you. Next we have, how do I help my husband be more comfortable with my faith transition and some of the lifestyle changes I'm contemplating?
Well, I'll have Jenny talk after me. One thing that I usually say is that it's really important not to make unilateral decisions without your spouse. So, but there's also a difference between asking for permission. So most of us didn't like asking for permission pretty much from age 2 on. And so you're not going to like that in your marriage. At the same time, you are a partnership, and it can be very threatening to a partner if you start changing kind of the standards or the guidelines or the ideas of how your family runs and how you're going to function as a couple. So I think there's that balance between having conversations, informing, maybe pausing. Maybe I'm not going to drink coffee right this second because it seems to be very upsetting to you, but just know this is something I'm interested in and I'd like to return to this discussion in a few months, et cetera, are kind of some examples of how you can kind of do that balancing act so that you both feel like at least you're informed and part of the conversation. Jenny, do you have something you want to add to that?
Yeah, as part of the renegotiation process, you need to recognize that uncomfortableness is going to be a part of that, right? So the question is, how do I make my husband comfortable with that? Well, you can't make your husband comfortable with that. Maybe with time and experience, you know, you might get more used to something, but initially, you know, he has a right to feel uncomfortable with that because it's a new thing, right?
I love it. And I also love that that thought made me think about measurement scales. So on a scale from 1 to 10, how uncomfortable is something? We tend to be black and white thinkers in Mormon land and in American land. So it's either yes or no, comfortable or not comfortable. It's like, well, this is at a level 8 uncomfortable for me. Okay, well, maybe I'm willing to pause. If it's a level 3 uncomfortable, maybe we're willing to move forward, right? So there can be discomfort at different on a different spectrum.
Thank you. That offers maybe a bit of a segue to this next question. Can an entire culture have difficulty with differentiation?
Yes.
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 Yeah.
And you're living in it. If you're in America, especially, I don't know, I can't speak to the experience of other places in the world, but I imagine this is very much a human-driven thing, right? So yes, whole groups. And specifically organizations come together and stick together because they are particularly in a place where they really like conformity. They really like the rules and they really like authority. And it is, it's a very safe, it's an important place to be for so many people. So I don't even want to minimize that at all. It's really, it can be really, really helpful. So, but most things in life, nothing is all good or all bad. I like to look at things as there are benefits and there are drawbacks. So there are benefits to those systems in terms of safety and safe places for growth. And there are drawbacks in the differentiation category. So this is one where, especially in our system, in our faith, in our culture, we have to spend a little more time developing that because it is not something we've learned. So
I would say Google the circumplex model. Google that.
Thank you. This probably needs to be our last question. We have just a minute. I crave emotional intimacy and my husband is currently not capable and has no intention or interest in learning how to speak emotion. How do you know whether to stay and settle or move on?
Sounds like an emotional faith transition. You're on different emotional spaces. Anybody want to tackle that one? Or
I'll say this, if I can. There could be other things going on in any relationship besides faith. So part of the process of determining what course is best for you is to break apart all those pieces with somebody who can navigate that with you and determine if there's other things that are showstoppers that may be unrelated to a faith transition or ways in which they can be changed and shifted.
Lisa?
I would just say that I get the question a lot from clients of like, when do I know that this marriage is over? And, or when do I know it's time to move on? And you know, one thing you should know is that most people take 6 years to decide if a marriage is over. So it takes a while. And really the only answer to that is that you know when you know. And I think it sort of goes back to that idea of boundaries and figuring out what do I want and how it's a complicated question, because we all are trying to balance our individual needs with our with the needs of our culture, our group, our system. And so when we're trying to figure out, you know, like how am I serving both of these, it's not easy to figure out what your boundaries are. But generally speaking, like when you know, you know. And it sounds like a circular answer, but if you're still wondering and if you're still grappling, you don't know yet. And at some point you'll stop grappling and you'll know. And I know that sounds like an inadequate answer, but because it's such a complex question and because it does take so long, that's the best one I have.
Thank you. Our time is up now, but I'd like to thank all of you for attending and for supporting Sunstone. I'll see you in the next session. Goodbye.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
And check out our giveaways. They're good.